This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In this, our next to the last show of 2010, we're going to look back on the year in film and pop. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, will be here with his 10 best list later in the show. Up first, our film critic, David Edelstein. David, good to have you back on the show. So let's get right to it. I'm going to ask you to read your 10 best list. You want to start with number 10 and work your way to the top film of the year?
Sure, except as usual, Terry, I don't have 10, I have 12. The reason I have 12 is because I just kept adding things and didn't, as I saw them, and didn't want to take other things out. I thought, why punish things that I love just because I saw something that I also loved?
The answer would be because 10 means 10, but go ahead, we'll let you take that liberty.
Well, let me start then working backwards. I'll start with Blue Valentine, which of course is this psychodrama with Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. Then I have Despicable Me, that wonderful Scrooge-like supervillain animated movie. Then a documentary a lot of people don't know called Marwin Call. Then Banksy's documentary, the nefarious, infamous graffiti artist documentary Exit Through the Gift Shop, which may or may not be a prank, but is great in any case. Then an Italian movie I think is a masterpiece called Vincere. It means win in Italian, and it's about Mussolini and his bride, his first wife. Then the film Mother and Child, Rodrigo Garcia's film with Annette Bening and Naomi Watts. Mike Leigh's film Another Year comes in the next place, and that opens very late this month. Toy Story 3, of course. I think that's a movie that many of us agree on. Please Give, Nicole Holofcener's great comedy starring Catherine Keener. I have a tie between two documentaries that touch on the global financial crisis in very different ways. Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer, and Inside Job. Finally, my best film of the year is Winter's Bone, Deborah Granik's harshly beautiful adaptation of Daniel Woodrell's Ozark noir novel.
So how did a little independent film like Winter's Bone end up topping your list?
Well, it's funny. I've been reading Daniel Woodrell's books for several years. He wrote the book Woe to Live On, which became the Ang Lee film Ride with the Devil. And it was about William Quantrell and the massacres done by Confederate soldiers in 1863 in the South. And ever since then, I thought, wow, you know, this guy sort of does what Cormac McCarthy does, you know, without a lot of the fuss and the pseudo-biblical language. And Winter's Bone is really his greatest novel. And when I went to see the movie, I thought, Deborah Granik, you know, not just got it right, but she deepened it. This is a film that could so easily be this dreary, depressing, regional, realistic kind of movie. And instead, she pushes it to the point where it achieves kind of a mythical intensity. I think it's a gorgeous, beautiful movie. And I don't understand why there are a lot of people who say, oh, it's so depressing. I thought it was an absolutely exhilarating movie, managing to be so hopeful in the midst of such horror.
So you are out of step with your own New York Film Critics Circle, which selected The Social Network as the top film of the year, as did the L.A. Film Critics. So I'm not saying it does belong on the 10 best list, but tell us why it's not on yours.
Yeah, I was sitting in the New York Film Critics Circle meeting, and it was on ballot after ballot after ballot, and I was getting this sinking feeling because I really wanted Winter's Bone to win. And it's going to win all the big critics' prizes, and it might win the Oscar. You know, it's going head-to-head with The King's Speech, I think. And I don't dislike The Social Network. I actually do like it. But I also think it's an enormously glib and cynical film about the impulses underlying our new way of life. While at the same time, I think it also appeals to this pervasive 21st century fantasy of wanting to be a billionaire. It's a good business saga, but I'm mystified by how many people seem to think it's this groundbreaking movie about a turning point in American culture.
You know, it's funny, the only two real commercial films in your top 10 or 12 are Despicable Me and Toy Story 3, both animated films. Most of the films are either documentaries or independent films on your list.
Yeah, and it's funny, too. And I, by the way, I like being entertained as much as the next person. I just can't get worked up over any mainstream film this year, with the exception of Toy Story 3 and Despicable Me, though I think Winter's Bone had every potential to cross over. The thing I want to say about Toy Story 3, though, is people were in tears, we know. But I don't know about you. I was crying. You know, people around me were crying. Although it is, you know, a great comedy, underneath it, it really is a story about death, about getting old, about losing your usefulness. And it has this weird almost, I don't want to sound too pretentious, I already do, but this almost Buddhist quality about investing these toys with spiritual properties and, you know, our deepest childhood feelings, and then what it means to cast them away or forget about them. Toy Story is very into sort of resurrecting those feelings that we had, you know, when our world was just kind of coming together, and that we've either repressed or we've suppressed. So it's not just shallow escapism. You can talk about Toy Story 3 probably more than you can talk about a lot of the art films on my list.
Were there any performers or directors who you feel came into their own this year, either first-time directors or actors or people who'd been around before? It wasn't until this year that you really saw what they could do.
Jim Carrey plays a gay con man in a film that's out now called I Love You, Philip Morris. And it's interesting to me because if you watch, have followed Jim Carrey over the years, he's always struck me as the kind of least psychologically filled in of modern clowns. There's something very desperate about him, as if he stopped doing his shtick on camera, that he would dissolve in front of your eyes. And playing a gay character, playing a closeted gay character, that desperation takes on astonishing emotional resonance when he's forced to live in a homophobic culture and to kind of parody normality. There's all this subterfuge and compartmentalization. They become second nature. And it turns out to be a perfect vehicle for his peculiar persona. I don't think the movie is quite a success, but the performance cuts very, very deep. I think it's probably the best male performance of the year. And I know he's, you know, doesn't have a chance at winning an Academy Award or a Critics Award this year, because Colin Firth is winning everything. And we know that Colin Firth gave the best performance of last year in A Single Man, for which he was pushed aside for Jeff Bridges. And now he's going to win everything for King's Speech, in which he's wonderful. But I think it's a little bit more gimmicky a performance than his extraordinary turn in A Single Man. The other performances, well, Annette Bening just continues to shock me with this kind of thing that she does that nobody else does. She plays people playing people. She plays people who in life are performing, who are putting on this mask and playing these roles, and then kind of specializes in showing you how the mask is constantly dissolving and then being put back on and then dissolving. And she's amazing in Mother and Child, Rodrigo Garcia's movie that is on my 10 best list that was an utter flop. She's going to win all the awards for The Kids Are All Right, in which she's wonderful, too. So that's an amazing performance. Patricia Clarkson in Cairo Time. Patricia Clarkson is a great clown. Who knew she could give a performance as a woman having a kind of quiet epiphany on a trip to Egypt, in which she's mostly alone? Amy Adams in The Fighter is wonderful. Kirsten Dunst is completely surprising in All Good Things. She gives a really mature and scarily good performance.
So, David, we've talked about some of your favorite films of the year. What are some of your least favorite, some of the films that you think are the worst of the year?
Well, there have been some extraordinarily bad films this year. On our screens right now, you can subject yourself or preferably someone you loathe to Tron Legacy, which looks like Disco Night at the Hyalife Ronton, and I'm convinced has given me a brain tumor. The Nutcracker in 3D. Oh, it's the Nutcracker stripped of dance and turned into this allegory of fascism. And some of the music, the Tchaikovsky music, is given lyrics, like Waltz of the Sugar Plum Fairies has two songs with that tune. And I'm telling you, there are few things less suited to having lyrics than It is not a tune that you can sing very well in a way that works with any sort of word. That's about how good Nathan Lane sounds in the movie. Even if it were well done, which it isn't, it would still be a terrible movie.
Do you have any good suggestions for movies to see over the holidays?
Everybody is asking me, why would the Joel and Ethan Coen remake True Grit? Wasn't it good enough the first time? How can anybody top John Wayne? And it's true that John Wayne was a terrific Rooster Cogburn, but evidently the Coens had some connection with the book by Charles Portis that the Henry Hathaway film didn't quite touch. It's written in this sort of quasi-biblical dialect that is very perverse, and because it's full of all this ghoulish imagery and killing and cynicism and nihilism, and obviously that's the Coens' bread and butter, and they've made an extraordinarily beautiful-looking film, very austere, but with these gonzo, over-the-top performances. It's like Jeff Bridges is no rival to John Wayne, but he's hilarious, even though you can barely understand what he's saying because he's often so drunk he can barely get the words out. And I've seen the movie twice. I was very disappointed the first time. The second time, I was actually very charmed by it. So I think if you lower your expectations, you'll have a great time.
As usual, there's a couple of films on your best of list that haven't opened nationally yet, so most of our listeners won't have had a chance to see these films. So you should tell us a bit about Blue Valentine.
Well, Blue Valentine is an extraordinarily intimate psychodrama. It stars Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams, and it's in two parts. It flashes back and forth between their kind of nutty courtship and their tortured dissolution. It's all handheld camera in very close to the actors, and you might come out hating it, or you might be just utterly enthralled at how intimate its portrait of a, you know, gradually dissolving relationship. It's already well known because it was slapped with an NC-17 rating by the MPAA, which Harvey Weinstein of the Weinstein Company appealed and appealed and appealed, and he finally got an R. And when you see the movie, it's nothing. It's a sex act, but it's not even completed. And compared to the things that the MPAA gives PG-13 to, these splattery movies in which people are incinerated in front of your eyes, you just can't believe that a little bit of sex is going to make them say, oh, no, kids can't possibly see it. The other film is Another Year, and anybody who knows Mike Leigh knows the way he works giving actors their parts and sending them out into the world and having them collect all kinds of data. And this is about a particular couple played by Jim Broadbent and Ruth Sheen, who are these kind of earth mother and earth father to a group of very, very lonely people who converge and complain. And it's another one of these movies that at times makes you want to jump off a bridge, but, you know, most of the time want to rescue somebody who's about to jump off a bridge and give them a big hug. So I couldn't recommend it more.
Well, David, I hope you get to see some great movies in 2011.
I know I will, because there are about 600 movies that open every year, and the odds are one of them's going to be good.
And you'll keep going until you find it.
I'm tireless.
All right. Well, I wish you happy holidays.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, and thanks so much for talking with us. David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can see his complete Best of the Year list, along with links to his reviews of those films on the list, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, will have his 10 best list later in the show. First, we'll hear about the new DVD Blu-ray edition of the classic Disney animated film Fantasia, which was released just in time for the holidays. Lloyd Schwartz will have a review after this break. This is Fresh Air. Just in time for the holidays, the classic animated Disney film Fantasia has been released in a new DVD Blu-ray edition. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
The visualization of music on film is an old impulse. During the 1930s, besides cartoons with classical music soundtracks, a number of short films like one called Optical Palm had kaleidoscopic, completely abstract images of musical pieces. But the most famous attempt to provide visual images for classical music was Walt Disney's Fantasia. Released in 1940, after Snow White and Pinocchio, it's really an anthology of short segments with very mixed results. Composer and music critic Deems Taylor, who helped select the music, introduces each section, and the conductor is Leopold Stokowski. The best-known sequence, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, is quite faithful to the story by Goethe that's depicted in Dukas' music. Only now it's Mickey Mouse who loses control of the magical broomsticks who flood the sorcerer's laboratory. So what you see on screen literally Mickey Mouses the music. Some of the musical choices are quite ambitious. Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony turns Beethoven's peaceful countryside images into a mythical Arcadia with flying horses and their families, and centaurs dating centaurettes who look like 1930s starlets only with four legs, and some of them decorously topless. It's definitely a kiddie version, but at least it keeps to the spirit of the music. So does the even more surprising sequence based on Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which changes Stravinsky's image of primitive Russia into an even more primitive depiction of prehistory, with erupting volcanoes, grazing brontosauri, a terrifying Tyrannosaurus rex, and flying raptors, clearly an inspiration for Avatar. Stravinsky actually liked the animation, though he rightly hated the abbreviation and restructuring of his great ballet score. My favorite sequence is Ponchielli's familiar Dance of the Hours. Here it's a parody of classical ballet, with ostriches and elephants as the corps de ballet. The male lead is a salacious alligator, and the prima ballerina a demure hippo in a flimsy tutu. It's hilarious and suits the music perfectly. Music composed for dancing was obviously intended to be seen, and works especially well in Fantasia, such as the passages from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite. It's amusing to hear Deems Taylor in 1940 say that while the suite is famous, nobody performs the ballet. Times have changed. This new set also includes a feature-length sequel called Fantasia 2000. It's mostly awful, butterflies in the Beethoven Fifth and whales in Respighi's Pines of Rome. Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue has some amusing moments inspired by theatrical cartoonist Al Hirschfeld. The best thing is a repeat of the original Sorcerer's Apprentice. The new Blu-ray also includes Destino, a bizarre 6-minute realization of an abandoned collaboration between Disney and Salvador Dali, a surrealist nightmare in more ways than one about a weird love affair. The music is a 1940s Mexican pop song, and the images include the hero's baseball bat slamming the heroine's severed head into space. Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, Dukha, even Stravinsky intended some of their music to be visualized, either in the imagination or in an actual theater. I love Disney's project, and for kids, it's a delightful introduction to classical music. But both Fantasia and its sequel reveal how difficult it is to arrive at convincing images. Visual artists have to be deeply sensitive to music, not to oversimplify or betray what's so deeply in it.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He reviewed the new Blu-ray DVD edition of Walt Disney's Fantasia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, and now for our final 10 best list of 2010. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has his list of the best recorded music he's heard this year. Ken, I'm looking forward to hearing your top 10 list, but before we hear it, was this an easy year or a difficult year to find 10 albums you loved that were worthy of a 10 best list?
It was a really vigorous, energetic year for lots of glossy pop music and lots of very sort of personal autobiographical sort of almost a throwback to 70s singer-songwriter kind of music.
So let's hear your list.
Yeah, my list is number one is Tracy Thorn. The album is called Love and Its Opposite. Arcade Fire and their album The Suburbs. Hot Chip, a British band, and their album is One Life Stand. Peter Wolf's Midnight Serenades, Joanna Newsom's Have One on Me, Elizabeth Cook with a terrific country album called Welder, The Drive-By Truckers with an album called The Big To-Do, Kanye West's My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, Marty Stewart's Ghost Train, and Robin's Body Talk.
So, Ken, is there a song from one of the albums in your top 10 that illustrates what you were saying before about some of these albums having very autobiographical songs that reminded you of 70s singer-songwriters?
Yes. My number one, the Tracy Thorn album, Love and Its Opposite, there are a lot of songs about not necessarily strictly autobiographical, she's happily married, but kind of character sketches of people that she knows or imagines who live in very unhappy marriages. And one of the best songs on the album, I think, to play is Oh, the Divorces.
Let's hear it.
Who's next? Who's next? Always the ones that you least expect. They seem so strong. It turned out she wanted more all along. And each time I hear who's to part, I examine.
That's Tracy Thorn with a song that's on the number one album on Ken Tucker's 10 Best of the Year list. So, Ken, there was one album on the top 10 that you did not review for Fresh Air, and that's the album by Robin, who I'll confess I was not familiar with. So tell us about her and the album and why you chose it for the 10 Best, even though you didn't review it.
Yes, Robin is a Swedish singer. She's a huge hit over in Europe and a kind of a dance club favorite over here. And it's kind of funny because she actually released three albums called Body Talk. And early in the year, she put out the first one. I thought, boy, that's terrific. I want to review that. And then I heard that she was going to put out a second album. And I thought, well, I'll wait till the middle of the year. And then middle of the summer, she put out the second Body Talk. And she announced that she was going to complete the trilogy by the end of the year. And so this final disc of Body Talk collects five songs from the first album, five songs from the second album, and five new songs. And I just think it's really a terrific example of up-to-the-minute dance music.
So would you like to play something from it?
Yes. There's a really good song called Indestructible.
Okay. Let's hear it. This is Robin. Robin from an album that's on our rock critic Ken Tucker's 10 Best list. Ken, what music really mattered this year? Mattered because it was musically innovative or mattered because it made a mark on culture?
I think a couple of albums that are in my top 10 fit that bill. Certainly the Kanye West album is really interesting in the sense that it's beautifully produced. It's very, very knotty and complex, both in the rhymes that Kanye West raps, and the production is just gorgeous. It's a very, very ambitious album. It's almost, you know, we might have called it a pop opera. It's a kind of long, sinuous journey through the subconscious of Kanye West, made very self-conscious. I think he's a really fascinating artist for a guy who gets involved in a lot of controversy. I think he's a very sensitive soul, and I think both sides of that egotism versus the sensitive artist plays out in that album. And at the other extreme, the Canadian band Arcade Fire and their album The Suburbs, that is a big booming rock album. It's just an old-fashioned album that's meant to be listened to as an album. The people who in the band say they thought of it as not a collection of singles or individual songs, but The Suburbs, which is the name of the album, is meant to be a kind of tour through the suburbs, what it's like to live in the suburbs, what it's like to be an adolescent, to be a parent. It's a kind of panoramic view in music.
Is there a track from either of those two albums you'd like to play?
Yes. I think an excellent song by Arcade Fire to play would be Month of May.
Okay. Here it is.
One, two, three, four.
Three of the artists that were dominant this year commercially, Katy Perry, Lady Gaga and Taylor Swift. You gave good reviews to their recordings, although they're not on your 10 best list. But those reviews got some complaints from our listeners. What were they complaining about?
There still seems to be this very strong feeling that glossy commercial pop music isn't quite authentic enough, that the bright pop sound of someone like Katy Perry or the sort of set-to-music diary entries of Taylor Swift or Lady Gaga, who delights in presenting herself as a kind of human art project, is somehow not worthy of consideration because it's not considered serious enough. I think this whole idea of authenticity is still very much at play in the minds of pop music listeners, and people get offended if they don't think you're addressing the most serious music of the day. I think a lot of people sort of listen to Fresh Air and expect to hear music that's not in the top 10 that they can't hear anywhere else. But I think it's important to talk about music that's very, very popular. And quite aside from that, I just think that Katy Perry is a tremendously interesting, funny, witty artist who's very knowing. She kind of plays with the pinup girl image and makes very bright, nice pop music. Taylor Swift, similarly, a very, very commercial country artist, not at all a hardcore country artist, but a really interesting songwriter, especially for one who's so young. And Lady Gaga kind of occupies that position that a few years ago someone like Tori Amos used to be. Might seem like an odd comparison, but Lady Gaga sits at that piano and pours out her angst in a meat dress, perhaps she's or some iridescent light bulb popping headdress that she has on. And it's the visual spectacle, as in the case of Katy Perry and Lady Gaga, that matters as much as the music. It's all part of the artistic statement.
Is there a track from Katy Perry or Lady Gaga that you'd like to play that you think really shows them off musically? I'd suggest Taylor Swift, except she's played all over the place. It's like you can't not hear Taylor Swift. So, yeah.
Well, I think that Katy Perry's single, California Girls, is a really terrific piece of pop music.
Okay, let's hear it.
I know a place where the grass is really greener. Warm, wet and wild. There must be something in the water. Sipping gin and juice.
That's Katy Perry, her hit song from this year, California Girls. And my guest is our rock critic, Ken Tucker, who's talking about the year in pop music. Last year, and actually over several years, we've talked about the impact television is having on pop music, both through the use of already existing recordings within TV shows and also through TV shows that are all about music, like American Idol and Glee. And I'm wondering how much you think television has had an impact this year on pop music, and in particular, Glee and American Idol.
I think television is hugely important. It's one of the primary ways in which people experience music for the first time in a lot of cases. And it's also the way images get presented of new pop artists. That's certainly the case of Lady Gaga that we just mentioned. Her appearing on awards shows helped cement her kind of phenomenon. And then for a specific show such as Glee, on the surface, Glee seemed to me like the next logical step after American Idol. It was young people covering pop songs. But the creator, Ryan Murphy, kind of added layers of jokes and irony and reintroduced to a new generation Broadway musical conventions. Cardboard, one-note characters, but they are characters that are easy to identify with and are nonetheless, you know, very funny, and they burst into song at any given moment. And I think the show makes the case for bombastic rock and pop from the 80s and the 90s as a kind of new American songbook. Now, I think that's wrong. I don't think that...
Why do you think that's wrong?
Because I think stuff like music by Journey and Rush will never stand the test of time as great American songbook classics. But I like the idea that Ryan Murphy has that thesis, that he wants to promote that idea. And he does it in the context of this very well-made show. All that said, I found this season of Glee to be almost unwatchable at times because it had become so self-conscious and so self-aware of the first season's success that it became almost kind of frozen in a self-conscious amber of irony. And so I wasn't crazy about Glee, but I could step back and really admire the phenomenon that essentially was the vision of one creator, Ryan Murphy, and the way he put together that cast and the extraordinary success. There were more singles on the Billboard charts from Glee cast members than any other pop or rock band in the country this year. So, I mean, that's a remarkable commercial achievement and shows, again, the power of television.
Yet American Idol, I don't even remember the name of the person who won.
Exactly. The past couple of times, the winner especially is, you know, forgotten after he or she makes the first record. I mean, it's only Adam Lambert who stands out in my mind as a kind of interesting pop figure, and even he's had a very rocky road of it. I mean, it remains to be seen now with the departure of Simon Cowell how the future of American Idol will unfold. This could very well be the season coming up where American Idol kind of collapses under the weight of its own cultural import, if I may refer to it in such heavy terms.
Well, talking about the impact of television on pop music, I think we have to talk about commercials because a lot of songs are kind of broken or popularized through commercials now, and a lot of old songs make their comeback through commercials. So what commercials caught your ear this year?
Well, one that really popped out at me was that I was watching a Volkswagen Jetta commercial. And it was a commercial that's set in a very urban setting about a guy who's trying to make some money to earn, buy a car, and he's taking these menial jobs in the big city. But the music behind it was Wynn Stewart's honky-tonk hit, Another Day, Another Dollar. This was a song that went to only number 27 on the country charts in 1962. And here it was being played underneath to try and sell you a new car, which I thought was completely fascinating. I love the sheer chance of that some music director said, hey, here's a song that's kind of interesting. Let's play this beneath this song. It makes for a nice contrast. And the song is terrific in itself. Wynn Stewart in himself is a fascinating story. He's a guy who was one of the architects of the Bakersfield sound along with Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, yet he's the forgotten man of the Bakersfield sound. He only had one number one hit, a song called It's Such a Pretty World Today, which I could sing to you right now.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm going to...
It's such a pretty world today. Look at the sunshine. It's a really great song. And yet, he's a guy who never quite got the right breaks. Just as he had that number one hit, he decided to open up a nightclub in Las Vegas. He left the recording industry. So for him to be rediscovered in 2010 for a 1962 song playing under a car commercial just seems to me one of the marvelous wonders of pop music.
Okay, well, you brought it with you. You want to play it for us?
Yes, I'd love to.
Okay, this is Wynn Stewart.
Another day, another dollar. Daylight comes, I'm on the way. Another day, another dollar. Working my whole life away. boss told me I'd get paid weekly. And that's exactly how I'm paid. Another day, another dollar, working my whole life away. Another day.
So that's Wynn Stewart, and you'll likely hear that song on a Volkswagen Jetta commercial, which is still, as far as I know, being played. So I didn't realize what an interesting and uncelebrated life he had had. So thanks for telling us about him, Ken.
Yeah, he's really a forgotten man of country music.
Now, you asked if we could conclude your year and wrap up with a recording by a singer-songwriter who died this year, Kate McGarrigle. I think that's a great idea. Tell us about who she was and why you love her music.
Well, Kate McGarrigle was half of the sister act, Kate and Anna McGarrigle. They were French-Canadian, born in Montreal. She was. She died of cancer in January of this year. And I just think that Kate McGarrigle wrote some of the most beautiful songs, some of them with her sister, some alone. And the music is just so spare and beautiful and tough-minded, yet very gentle and romantic at its heart, but having that kind of hard-headed common sense, a kind of realism, the kind of realism that you have to have if you're a woman who was married to Loudon Wainwright III, and are the mother of Rufus Wainwright, among other children. She was just a wonderful woman. I did have the opportunity. I don't do many interviews, but I did interview Kate and Anna McGarrigle a couple of times. And Kate always had this really wonderful kind of quiet sarcasm and real. What I noticed most about so-called sensitive singer-songwriter types is that when you actually meet them, they're very tough characters. And I think all those winters up in Quebec helped harden those women, and Kate McGarrigle in particular. So I really mourn her death.
What song would you like to play by her?
I'd like to play a song that Kate wrote herself and performs on piano called I Eat Dinner.
I love this song. I'm glad you chose it. It's a beautiful melody and a really heartbreaking lyric.
Yes.
Thank you, Ken. I hope you have happy holidays and a happy new year.
Same to you. Thanks, Terry.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic and editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. After we recorded our conversation, we thought it would be nice to hear the version of I Eat Dinner that Kate McGarrigle recorded with her sister Anna in our studio back in 1993.
Never thought like this.
my daughter, who is now 17. We eat leftovers with mashed potatoes. No more candlelight, no more romance, no more small talk when the plate is clean. No more candlelight, no more romance, no more small talk when the hunger is gone.
The late Kate McGarrigle performing with her sister Anna in the Fresh Air Studio in 1993. Kate died in January at the age of 63. You can find our rock critic Ken Tucker's Best of the Year list on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Henry Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.